The Meaning of Marxism by Paul D'Amato. Section. What does a revolution look like? A social revolution is not a military coup by a handful of plotters. Nor is it simply a change of personnel at the top as a result of mass protests. Mass protests can overthrow a government, as we've seen many times in Latin America. But often the overthrow has only put another leader in power, without changing the fundamental class relations in society. Unless the state is overturned and conditions are created for the creation of new social relations, a political rather than a social revolution has taken place. Trotsky described socialist revolution as the direct interference of the masses in historic events, the forcible entrance of the masses into the realm of rulership over their own destiny. The question of revolution always boils down to a contest for power, in which a new class imposes a new order on the ruins of the old by deposing the old ruling class. We know that the state often resorts to violence even when the struggle is not revolutionary. Witness the way the US police come out in full riot gear every time a peaceful anti-war protest is organized. Imagine what they might do if millions of workers attempted to seize control of the factories, hospitals, and schools to run them democratically. Perhaps that's why socialists are often confronted with the question, isn't the state too powerful to challenge? This seems to be an unsolvable paradox. Piecemeal reforms are incapable of transforming society, and yet revolution will be met with superior force and defeated. Perhaps the best we can hope for are minor changes that don't threaten the power of bosses. This is wrong on two counts. First of all, the more militant and united the struggle, the greater the chances that even minor reforms will be successful. Second, there are plenty of examples of powerful regimes falling under the weight of mass revolt that before their fall seemed impregnable. No one predicted the fall of the Shah of Iran, protected by his dreaded secret police, in 1978. The Western press treated the Eastern European states as impregnable fortresses of Stalinist tyranny before they fell in 1989. The view that the state is all-powerful is based on a misconception of what revolutions are and the conditions that give rise to them. Revolutions succeed not because those who are rebelling have superior arms. If that were a requirement, a revolution could never win. Revolutionary situations arise only when millions of ordinary people become convinced that society can't continue in the old way, and when there are splits and confusion at the top over how to restore order and overcome the crisis. As Lenin wrote, quote, "To the Marxist, it is indisputable a revolution is impossible without a revolutionary situation. Furthermore, it is not every revolutionary situation that leads to revolution. What, generally speaking, are the symptoms of a revolutionary situation? 1. When it is impossible for the ruling class to maintain their rule without any change. When there is a crisis in one form or another, among the upper classes, a crisis in the policy of the ruling class, leading to a fissure through which the discontent and indignation of the oppressed classes burst forth. For a revolution to take place, it is usually insufficient for the lower classes not to want to live in the old way. It is also necessary that the upper classes should be unable to live in the old way. 2. When the suffering and want of the oppressed classes have grown more acute than usual. 3. When as a consequence of the above causes, there is a considerable increase in the activity of the masses, who uncomplainingly allow themselves to be robbed in peacetime, but in turbulent times are drawn by all the circumstances of the crisis, and by the upper classes themselves, into independent historical action." End quote. For a period, a rising movement can throw the state and the ruling class it represents onto the defensive. Divisions develop at the top over how to restore order. Should reforms be granted to mollify the movement, or should repression be used, or both? Reforms are granted. Instead of stopping the movement, placating it, the reforms embolden the movement, which draws into its train all of the oppressed and exploited, women, national minorities, and others. Sections of the ruling class and the military begin to debate the possibility of restoring order by force, i.e., by physically crushing the rising. Reactionary forces begin testing the defenses of the movement, probing for its weakest spots. Society balances on a knife's edge. Will the old order reimpose itself, or will new social forces seize power? This is the essence of all revolutionary situations. Of course, if those leading the movement are able to channel the struggle into reforms that do not fundamentally challenge the status quo, then it is possible that the movement can be diffused before it reaches revolutionary proportions. When this happens, as it did after the May 1968 general strike in France, for example, the movement subsides and the old order is able to restore itself. But if workers are convinced that they can and must move forward, then the only two choices are a dispersal of the old state power by the united working class, leading millions behind it, or the suppression of the movement. A necessary feature of every revolutionary situation is dual power. The existence of popular forms of power, workers' councils, alongside the old state. But dual power cannot last. In all revolutionary situations, either society moves forward to the establishment of a new state based upon workers' councils or some similar form of direct democracy, or backward to the destruction of the workers' organizations and the reestablishment of capitalist order. The formation of workers' councils of some sort is a precondition for socialism. But whether workers win or not is a question of power. The working class can only become the new power if it disperses the old power. For that, the working class must not only be organized, it must have behind it the majority of the oppressed and whole sections of the middle class. And it must also be armed and ready to defend its control of workplaces and the streets. Force must be decide in the end, because, as we've already pointed out, the ruling class will use the utmost force to stay in power. Trotsky wrote after his experience as president of the main workers' council in Petrograd in the 1905 Russian Revolution, quote, "In struggle, it is extremely important to weaken the enemy. That is what a strike does. At the same time, a strike brings the army of the revolution to its feet. But neither the one nor the other, in itself, creates a state revolution. The power still has to be snatched from the old rulers and handed over to the revolution. That is the fundamental task. A general strike only creates the necessary preconditions. It is quite inadequate for achieving the task itself. At a certain moment in revolution, the crucial question becomes, on which side are the soldiers, their sympathies, and their bayonets?" End quote. In mass upheavals, the weakest link of the ruling class is the armed forces. Repression can only work if soldiers are disciplined to carry out their orders. But in circumstances of great social upheaval, this isn't a foregone conclusion, because most soldiers are themselves workers. If this were not true, revolutions could never win. A mass movement can fight for the hearts and minds of soldiers, thereby splitting the military and winning soldiers to the side of the revolution. The all-powerful state then becomes temporarily paralyzed because it cannot rely on its own armed forces. But the movement must be strong enough and provide a clear program that convinces the soldiers that the movement can win. This is what happened in the 1917 revolution in Russia. Trotsky describes in his classic History of the Russian Revolution how, in the midst of mass street demonstrations, even the crack Cossacks sent to suppress protests winked as soldiers dived under their horses, and regular soldiers turned their guns on the police when they attacked the crowds. During the 1877 Great Railroad Rebellion in the United States, the first mass national strike wave in U.S. history, many of the local militias refused to attack striking railroad workers. A local Pennsylvania militia was sent out to crush a strike on the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad after workers seized control of company property. The militiamen made it clear that they would report for duty, but, quote, if ordered to fire, they will lay down their arms, that they are working men and do not desire to kill other working men. The late British Marxist Tony Cliff described a similar process during the 1975 Portuguese Revolution. Quote, the families living in the shanty town of Bairro de Boa Vista in the outskirts of Lisbon took over a housing estate that had stood empty for 3 years. An army company was deployed to force the families back to the corrugated lean-tos of the shanty town. The officer in charge went straight to what he thought was the weakest link, an old widow who had just moved with her 6 sons to a 2-bedroom flat with electricity. She replied, "You better shoot me right here. All my life I had the earth for a floor. At least I will die on a proper floor." The officer stood there for a moment. Outside, the men and women and children who had assembled to resist any eviction were speaking to the soldiers. "This could be your shanty town. Remember that you too are the people. Turn the guns on the speculators and not on your brothers and sisters." The officer understood and, taking the company with him, left the estate. End of section.